conservation of energy is a lesson we could all learn from the horses. For a horse, if they expend energy unnecessarily, then they don't have enough energy to get away from the lion or go to the next watering hole. Humans are expending energy unnecessarily all the time. The kind of tyranny of email, artificial emergencies that come across our desk, and we're blowing energy all the time instead of conserving our energy. And part of what presence does is it allows us to be deeply attuned to the moment, and we really think, is this a conversation I need to have? Is this an email I have to respond to right now? And the more that we conserve our energy, then we use our energy for things that are more important.
Welcome to Potent, the podcast where we explore transformative ideas and practices to help you live into your unique potential and build a more potent life. I'm your host, Stephen Lawson, a whole person productivity coach and founder at Monk Manual. Today, I'm joined by my friend Kelly Wendorf, founding CEO of Equus, a leadership development firm focused on taking people through transformative change and onto meaningful levels of success, purpose, and profound fulfillment. Inspired by the wisdom of horses, her work has been featured in Forbes, Vogue, Huffington Post, and the New York Times. Her latest book, Flying Lead Change, 56 Million Years of Wisdom for Leading and Living, invites us to look at the evolutionary intelligence of nature and nature-based wisdom to meet the challenges we face today. In today's episode, we cover the connection between leadership and spirituality, what horses teach us about the virtue of presence, and why authenticity may be the very thing that unlocks our true potential. I really appreciate my time with Kelly, and I think you will as well. This podcast is brought to you by the Monk Manual. The Monk Manual is dedicated to providing best-in-class tools for helping you build a more potent life and experience peaceful being and purposeful doing on a daily basis. If you'd like to be more intentional with your time and energy, please visit monkmanual.com. All right, let's dive in. Welcome to the Potent Podcast. Today, our guest is Kelly Wendorf, an accomplished executive coach, celebrated author, spiritual mentor, and entrepreneur. Kelly's dedicated her life to unlocking the potential within individuals and organizations using a wisdom-informed and holistic approach. Raised in harmony with nature in the ancient world, Kelly cultivated a sensitivity to the interconnectedness of people, nature, and their inherent moments. With vast experience living globally and studying through spiritual indigenous cultures and leaders from India, Africa, Indonesia, and Australia, she has a unique multicultural perspective. I first connected with Kelly through the Monk Manual, and since then have learned quite a bit about what she's doing and have just found it extremely fascinating and interesting. So I can't wait to introduce Kelly and her work to you today through the Potent Podcast. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. I'm so happy to be here and such a fan of what you do.
So Kelly, let's start by just having you explain a little bit about what it is that Equus does. Am I even pronouncing it the right way?
You are.
Okay.
Yes, Equus. So Equus is Latin for horse. Mm-hmm. And the reason I chose to name my company after the Latin word for horse is because so much of my life as a human, a professional, a teacher, a mentor has been informed by the horse. They were my connection to the natural world. And so later in life, when I created the business, I really deliberately wove together nature-based experiences for my clientele so that they could ground themselves in a deeper wisdom when they were learning leadership skills and human development skills that, when paired with nature and nature-based principles and nature-informed wisdom practices, we just found that the work went a lot deeper. So we're in the business of rewilding folks. And what I mean by that is liberating them from limiting narratives and domesticated beliefs that would hem them in and keep them from living their most authentic lives, their most meaningful, purposeful, passionate expressions of themselves. So that's what we like to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love that. And I want to dig in there, actually pick up on that topic of rewilding, because I think that if people haven't heard a term like that before from a distance, it can almost sound like a dangerous term, right? Like, yes. Okay, well, we're going to go and this is going to make me forget about all my responsibilities, or maybe it's going to just some sort of place that maybe threatens what in their own mind is their own potential, right? Because because I think from a young age, we even through our education systems, we're brought up in such a way that we're kind of being formed in a particular way to be particular kind of units of society to fit a particular use case, and we find our place in the world. So then the idea of being wild, it's like, okay, well, that sounds a little bit dangerous. But I imagine that when you think of rewilding, you're not necessarily saying, okay, let's go and like break everything in your life. You're saying, let's open up new possibilities. So what are those possibilities? When you talk about the idea of rewilding, what really is the transition that ends up happening for a person as you've experienced it?
That's such a great question. And that's right. I mean, it does conjure, you know, dreadlocks and tattoos, and I'm just going to abdicate all of my responsibilities. But really, rewilding is one of the safest things you can do, because you're returning back to your authentic self. So yes, we all have to belong to a larger kind of order of things. But there's a funny kind of twist that often happens inside a culture that is largely disconnected, that belonging bends into conformity. And belonging and conformity are kind of near enemies, right? We talk about in the Buddhist tradition this concept of near enemies. Pity and empathy, or pity and compassion, are near enemies. And there are these two concepts that live close together, but one is a shadow side and one is a light side. So oftentimes we learn just to conform rather than to belong. And to belong, you have to be deeply tethered to your own self. Who am I? What do I stand for? What are these deeper voices that are kind of inside me that direct me to what I am to do on this planet? Why was I put here? And so I say that that's very safe, because if you don't belong to yourself, where do you belong? And it's one of the reasons I love Monk Manual, because you're constantly turning people back towards this inquiry of being, who am I? And how do I know that? And how do I establish a relationship with myself? So a lot of my work is about turning people's attention towards that inquiry. And it can feel unsafe, because you might start breaking with certain rules that you've been adhering to that do not serve you, saying yes when you really need to say no, staying with a job too long when really there's a book that longs to be written by you. Rewilding is about turning that ear towards, why were you born? Why did life go to all this trouble and miraculously bring you forward? That sometimes scares people, because you're not going to have a consensus reality around you to say, yes, Steve, you are doing the right thing, and here's why. You have to kind of know it inside yourself, and that takes courage.
Mm-hmm. I love this so much. And part of it is because when I even reflect on my own journey, even with the Monk Manual has never been this theoretical idea, or just even an idea of, hey, let's go and come up with some sort of product that I can go and figure out how to sell. It's always been very deeply tied to my own personal journey.
Yeah.
And I'm really serious about that, really serious about trying to figure certain things out, to live authentically, to try and maybe manifest a potential in myself that can create the greatest good, right? Which is inherently a dangerous act. It feels dangerous, because it always means like there's certain things that are having to be questioned, unsettled. And I think what you were just talking about, which is this idea of rewilding, can appear dangerous because it's like, okay, well, maybe I'm going to become bad, or I'm going to do something that's quote unquote bad. But if you go a step deeper than that, it's probably actually rooted in some level of fear of like, well, if I do things that are bad, will I actually still have this belonging? Right? Will I still be able to fit in this way or that way? And there is this sense that I have, and granted, this is somewhat anecdotal, but that journey of stepping into oneself and really trying to figure out who we are ourselves, not so much how we're defined by other people, but really kind of where our own internal compass is directing us, it feels very, very dangerous. But at the same time, it's really the only way that I think actual true belonging ends up being created. when I look at my own life, I feel like there's kind of like social contracts that I would enact with the world where it's almost like I'd build a certain persona. And that works. We all build certain personas and they can work right for us. They can be functional. They can work to a degree, but we'll feel like a certain malaise or disconnection because that persona is not truly us. And so on one hand, it seems extremely dangerous of like, what if I actually listen to the potential that's there, like really do what I feel like is right? I might lose all these things. But the other side of that is if you don't do that, you're always going to feel some level of disconnection, not only from others, but even from yourself. So it's a really fundamental question. So I want to bring this back because I have virtually no experience with horses. I went to a summer camp once when I think I was in sixth grade and I rode a horse there. I think I've ridden some ponies at like state fairs or things like that. And what also is interesting is in the Monkman community, we have a number of people who do therapy work with horses who, so there's something there, but I'd love to have you maybe share a little bit about what was it that helped you to see this connection between this idea of helping people kind of grow into their potential, of growing into a fuller expression of themselves, of rewilding, and seeing how somehow there's a Venn diagram between that and what horses can give us when we interact with them?
Yeah, so fantastic. And I just love hearing what you're talking about. And I do want to mention that the Monk Manual and its creation and your position as the visionary behind it, that is exactly an expression of rewilding right there. It's a solid business and you are doing great things in the world with it and changing lives, but it's an expression of your truest authentic calling. So I had an experience, and it's in my book, Flying Lead Change. My father's an archaeologist, and he spent a lot of his time in Africa and Egypt and the Sudan. And so that sort of granted me a really uncommon childhood. When I was seven, my father took myself, my little brother, and my mother to Ethiopia. And that was, you know, Ethiopia in the 1970s. Two white children in the bush of Ethiopia were a kidnapping target, and there were baboons. So my father hired an Oromo warrior to be our guard, our guardian, and to watch over us. And his name was Kabata, and he was hired to keep us safe. And the Oromo people are the indigenous people, or some of the indigenous people of northern Africa. And Kabata was this stunning, elegant being who walked into my life and completely turned it upside down. We became friends. You know, we didn't speak the same language. We weren't from the same culture, obviously, but we became really close friends. And there was a kind of love and belonging that showed up for me with him that I had not experienced in my contemporary culture. And we had a moment when many weeks later we had to leave. And he was, you know, normally he was standing like a sentinel with his spear and his beautiful garment slung over his shoulder. And even at night he stood by our door, propped up on one leg and a spear. But this morning when we were about to leave, he was in a chair by the door, just really slumped over. And I was too young to understand. I was never going to see Kabata again. You know, we were leaving. And so I jumped into his lap and I could just feel something was different. And I, you know, put my hands on his face. I looked at his face and he was crying. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a man cry. And something happened in this moment where his tears, the way he was sort of holding me in his arms, you know, he was this long, 7 foot tall, like creature. He just sort of folded me into his arms and he's sobbing. And it woke me up from a trance that is a trance that all of us as contemporary humans have been inside of. And that trance is we are separate. We are separate from life. We are separate from the trees and the rocks and all living beings. And this kind of love, this love and connection and belonging from this human who was not disconnected from nature. It's like it gave my body and my mind and spirit a download. And that moment forever changed my life and set me on a trajectory of, well, what is this? You know, And what is this trance? And what is this trance costing us? And how do we wake up from it? And it took me on a very, very long spiritual journey in my young adult years. And my becoming an executive coach arose from this desire to partner with people, really to wake them up to their highest selves. And I found that as a coach, unless the people had a felt somatic experience of this awakening, it's all just, you know, theory. It's all just cognitive stuff that people don't get. They have to get what I got. They have to have a felt sense of something that changes not just their mind, but their heart and their body and sets them on a different trajectory. So, you know, I can't find a bunch of Kabbatas and make that happen. But what I did notice was, as a horse person, I'd been with horses my whole life. When people were partnered with horses inside the right context, something similar happened to them. They may not know it. They may not be able to articulate it, but something happens. So about 10 years ago, I decided to pair my coaching business with horses. So I have 8 equines that if some of my clients so choose, they can come here and work with the horses and have experiences that what happens for them in 30 minutes would take 5 years on a spiritual quest in India. I've since found ways that even if you don't come out here and work with the horses, that you can have these experiences. And I've just learned to partner with nature in lots of different ways so that I can make a Zoom conversation, bring in these elements. We're wired for connection. We're wired for peace and love. We are wired to be connected to all that is. And so it doesn't take much to just flip a tiny little switch inside people and all the lights come on. Mm-hmm. It's quite amazing. Mm-hmm.
I do know what you're talking about. There's this, it's almost as if there's moments where everything kind of falls into the background. So much of our life can be, and even the anxieties of life, it's like we see it for what it is, that it's like just one big drama, but it's just a drama. And then all of a sudden, like the set falls down and you see like, or you connect with something deeper than that, that feels more in some ways potent, but also more important and strangely more real. That's something Yes. that I've been trying to walk around is that usually when we think of something, it's like, oh, is this real? It's like, yeah, it's materially real, right? Like I can feel this desk. It's materially real based upon certain senses. But there is a sense we have, like a felt sense, which touches something far more real. I don't know. I've actually tried to explain it to people. I don't think they've ever really understood it. And maybe that's because I don't know how to translate it. It's probably like, okay, if I wanted to explain the color purple to someone, maybe I could go and explain it through red and blue, but still it's different from actually seeing it. And I think that this level of touching reality, it transcends, then it really moves mm-hmm. more to like a primary color, like introducing a new primary color. So
yes.
So maybe you could share a bit more about, is it the sort of thing where you had just noticed that being around horses, you were able to have this experience, then you kind of tested it out mm-hmm. and brought that in with some of your executive coaching, or how mm-hmm. did that work?
Well, so there were many different tracks in my life, mm-hmm. and one of them was, you know, the horsemanship track. Horses are fantastic emissaries of the natural world because there's a part of them that is always a little bit wild, right? If you let a horse go out the gate into other places, they're just going to go. Being able to catch them is not going to be very easy. With dogs, they'll come back, but horses sort of lean into the natural world in a much more, and it's possibly because they're animals of prey, but they're highly relational. So you have this partner who is wedded to the natural world, but who is very happy to partner with you at the same time. When I was in my 20s, I left the corporate sector and started my own business, a riding school and horse training business. And you know, in my 20s, because I didn't have a teacher to say, hey, this is what happened with Kibata. This is what you woke up to. I had to kind of flounder in my own exploration. So it's not like everything was perfectly clear for me in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And when I worked with people with horses, I noticed, wow, you know, kids are getting along better with their siblings. They're making straight A's now. Women are leaving toxic marriages. Good things are happening for people, and they're just throwing their leg over a horse. What's going on here? And that took many years to sort of figure out. But it was clear to me that in the right conditions, and it's the conditions are one of curiosity, I want to follow my dreams, I want to follow something, those sorts of conditions. If they're at play, the horse is right there to serve in that way. They're also happy to just act like stupid animals and win ribbons or whatever, and they'll do that. They're that compassionate. But when you change the context, they just completely show up, and it's phenomenal what they do. It can sometimes seem subtle, but once I help people to see how the horse is communicating, how they're modeling things, they don't need me to translate it. Mm-hmm. So I ran away from the whole horse world for a while because there's elements of it that can be very, very toxic. And we all, myself included, told ourselves we love our horses, but really they were just slaves to our whims and what we wanted to do. So I had to make a very big shift in my approach to training horses and being with horses. And that took many, many years. I had to undo everything I learned and relearn something brand new as if I was a beginner. And that took probably 10 years. And that was sort of in private, all the while I was coaching and facilitating. But after that cycle was over, and I really felt like I earned my place as a true partner with a horse, then we could work together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've read your book over the last few weeks. You can see there's a lot of pages that have been earmarked. And well, first of all, one thing I want to commend you on, something I really love personally, and I don't know if this is a universal desire, but I really love authenticity and personal honesty. Like when it doesn't seem like someone is speaking just from like pure theory, or so often when I read books that you could quote unquote call maybe like self-help, I just, I'm struck with a sense of this person did research, but it's not real for them in any way. And it's not actually tied to their own kind of discovered wisdom or even taught wisdom. It's just like, here's an opportunity to go and kind of get people motivated around this or that. I didn't get that sense at all with what you were presenting. I got a sense that it was a real desire to kind of explain the things that you've discovered through various mentors like Uncle Bob, which hopefully we'll be able to talk about a little bit later, but the various mentors, the different life experiences. And what you were just talking about when you were explaining your process with relearning how to work with the horses or maybe train the horses and also your transition from the corporate world, I've gotten this sense that a lot of your path, there's always been this desire to maybe live in an authentic way or move towards that which is more true to ultimately like your own gift and your own potential. How that's actually looked, though, is a lot of birth and rebirth, a lot of tearing things down, building it back up, tearing things down, building it back up. And first of all, I think that a lot of people who are listening can relate to that. Because that's what a lot of people go through. But one thing specifically I want to talk to you about in your own journey is specifically how you've come to navigate tying in maybe what would be loosely called the spiritual with the corporate. The reason I share that is because the Monk Manual is really interesting. And most of the people who will be listening, chances are they have some interest in spirituality. But we tend to attract high achievers. They're people who are leading companies. They're people who are high-level managers. They're people who are maybe entrepreneurs. Not everyone. And also, that doesn't make you better to be those things. I mean, there's people who are doing all sorts of roles. But a lot of times, they're people who have applied themselves to their tasks of life in a pretty serious way. And something I'll find even in my own coaching is that sometimes there can be a real difficulty where it's like, even if you have this interest in spirituality, or you've maybe touched that thing, you've touched that point of connection, there's a real fear of like, yeah, but people don't understand this. How are people going to perceive me if I actually lead with this? And I think why I'm so interested in hearing kind of your journey around that specifically is because you're at a point now where you're kind of leading, it seems like, with a sense of like, yes, like I'm not hiding the fact that this has to do with something other than, in a sense, you're even calling out some of the problems with pure commercial ways of thinking about things, right? Mm-hmm. And you've leaned more into like, actually that's, I mean, you could even argue that the premise of Flying Lead Change is it's really arguing for like more of like a spiritual revitalization of sorts, right? Into a lot of different aspects of culture. That's what I took from it, or one of the things I took from it. So tell me, what was that journey like for you? And was that a difficult journey to kind of own that? Because I think a lot of people struggle with owning those things that they know to be true, but they're like, how could anyone else accept this?
You know, it was a struggle. And you talk about tearing things down and building things up. And even the way you describe it sounds noble, right? Mm. But in fact, it felt clumsy. It felt lost. It felt vulnerable. There were way more moments of feeling lost and confused and broken and damaged than moments of like, aha, you know? And I think kind of that's by design. I think that's the creating of a person who has confidence to bring forward in the world what she knows she needs to bring forward. So it was hard. And really only in the last, I'd say, well, 10 years, it's interesting, it's when I brought the horses in, that I started to feel more confident with who I was in the world, and that I could no longer parse out, oh, this part's acceptable to bring forward and this part isn't. One of the biggest influences was reading a book called The Living Company by Arie de Goes, who was the head of strategic planning for Royal Dutch Shell. And I'm going to way oversimplify here, but basically he was arguing that if living organisms are made up of molecules, which are made up of cells and then become organs, and then we become, you know, we're a human. Well, by extension, organizations are living because they're made up of molecules, which are made up of organs, which are made up of humans, and many humans make an organization. And it was just a little twist where I went, wow, they're living. Organizations are living. If they're living, well, that's spiritual. That's what gave me the courage to kind of go, okay, well, if organizations are spiritual, if they're living, and to me, life is spiritual, right? Life, livingness, beingness, all of these words we use, this is the greater kind of collective, the concentric field of all that is. And, you know, you and I could go off on that forever. Well, if the people in the organizations don't think that organizations are living, that doesn't matter. Organizations are living. So how do I want to engage with these huge living entities? Well, I want to engage with them like I would engage with you in this shared field of possibility and livingness together. And I think that was sort of the beginning where I started to say, you know what? I don't care. Out of 10 people, 2 may resonate with the way that I am in the world, but that resonance is going to be gold. That is going to mean so much to me. So when I speak to a group of CEOs who have never met me before, and I instruct them to go out to the forest and talk to a tree, I am wearing a suit and I am speaking to them in the exact same tone as if I had just said to them, we're going to sit down and work with this strategic plan, in the exact same tone. I don't apologize for it. I don't explain it. And that works. And the more I've done it, the more I then begin to live it. And even to the point now where, you know, in my bio, I say spiritual mentor. And I used to be like, I don't want to do that. Part of that too is because, as you and I both know, the new age spiritual industrial complex has pretty much hijacked so much of this for its own commodification, which is too bad, right? So we have to kind of dance between these lines of commodification and materialism and things that have emerged in the new age movement. But we have to reappropriate the words. You know, let's reappropriate presence. Let's reappropriate the word beingness. Let's reappropriate these words. They're our words, and they're real words. They don't belong to this spiritual New Age movement that would make billions of dollars off of these pure experiences.
I think that's something that's really difficult. There can be a fear of being misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason for that is because you do have to have language. Like, human beings are always trying to categorize people. Mm-hmm. Like, I guarantee, for example, we have a pretty diverse audience, right? Different backgrounds. People are probably listening right now thinking, okay, who is this woman? How do I categorize her? Right?
Right.
Is she like this person? Is she like that person? And I can tell you try to resist that. I try and resist that as well.
Yes. Right?
Because there is like a discrediting that ends up coming from that. It just is the case, right? Where maybe someone's a Democrat, and if they say they're a Democrat to someone, the other person immediately thinks of a certain type of person or a certain type of things, and maybe that discredits the person. Or if they say they're a Republican, or if they say they're a Christian, or if they say they're a Buddhist, or if they say... And so we're always trying to categorize people. But the difficult thing is when we really touch kind of the deeper sense of self, we realize like we personally are beyond category. None of us experience ourselves as if we're in this specific category, and yet still we try to engage each other in these ways. I think very mm-hmm. few people, even within their particular quote unquote tribes, truly feel a sense of belonging. Plus, a lot of organizations have kind of dissolved in one way or another, even like local community groups, they don't exist as much. How have you found, as you're trying to not be put into particular categories that you know have maybe been either commercialized or they're completely misunderstood, how have you found your own sense of belonging and community in the midst of that?
Wow. There's a few things that want to be said here. So this may sound a little esoteric, but I think we can go here together. Everybody's brain does this categorization. It's a part of the way our primitive brain just stays safe. You know, like, oh, I know that that's a saber-toothed tiger, you know, and I'm to run away from the saber-toothed tiger. And that's a dentist, and that's a woman, and that's a man. The invitation is to be so present in this moment, so present that you are being in the space that is prior to that labeling. Mm. And when you live from that place, you become that and you see others in that way. Now, that doesn't mean that when someone cuts me off in traffic, I don't make some snarky remark. Like, there's still all these parts of me that are just as human as the next and as flawed as the next. But there is always this opportunity to be so present that you're in this very moment. And being in that moment as much as possible and living from that moment is the way that I sort of dance between ways that folks want to label me or want to box me in or box in what I do. It really comes down to what you're constantly pointing to in the Monk Manual, to this being present in the moment. Now, a lot of folks are like, well, I can be present in the moment from 9 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. when I meditate. But my teachers have taught me that presence is every micro moment that you allow yourself to drop in. So even in this moment, when I'm having this conversation with you, I am there. So it's always just this invitation to keep coming back to that. So folks might say, yeah, but if I'm present like that, I won't forecast future. I won't, you know, I won't think about next week. I'll just drop all of my obligations. You have to try it. That's all I can say. Mm-hmm. You have to try it. It's not like that. And to the microscope of the mind, it's never going to figure out how you do that. You just have to do it. It's an experience of doing that. So I don't know if I'm answering your question quite, but the mind has a defense mechanism so that it can create order in its world. And part of the way it does that is by creating labels. And that's fine. We can't stop the mind from doing that, but we don't have to believe it quite so much. Kind of what you were saying earlier, that there's this whole play and drama happening out there, and it's always going to happen, but it's not as important as this present moment. and this being here now. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm even noticing that I think the reason I was asking the question or the genesis of it probably comes from my own reflections and my own desire to navigate that in various ways. I mean, that is actually a thing I've been working through for a long time. Doing this podcast is actually, it's a personal practice. Yeah, I want to help people. Yes, I want to kind of expand the reach of the ideas around the monk manual, all sorts of different things. But I wouldn't do it if it wasn't on a deeper level for the reason that I think it's important for me to put myself out there a little bit more. And it feels just correct for me. It feels like something that's creative and that I'm drawn toward and that it's just the right thing. And I'm trusting that. But it's interesting because even asking that question, it's coming from the place in me that wants to control and control people's experience of me.
Right.
And control what other people think of me.
Right.
And make sure that I'm safe and make sure that I have belonging. So it all circles back. And what I was hearing in your answer is like, if you really just focus on presence, and this is true, I mean, at least in my experience, when you really focus on being present, a lot of that stuff, it does fade away because you're just there.
Yes. It's just this shift in attention, and where we put our attention is kind of the world we create, right? So if you have your attention on, oh, what do these people think of me and what's it going to be like and will people like my podcast? But again, I have to emphasize, everybody's brain does this. Their brains will not stop doing this. It is futile to try and change what our brains naturally do. Mm-hmm. What we can do is change where our attention is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's it. Super simple. And the more our attention is there, the less other things build. So if our attention is on this pain in my leg, that's going to start building more. We'll focus more on that when we get a doctor about it. Then we'll take more aspirin about it. Where do we put our attention? And when we put our attention on presence, it infuses everything else. Mm-hmm. Conversation just goes better. The decisions just happen with a bit more clarity. So presence sort of helps everything else out. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And I want to add one thing. You had mentioned earlier, you know, there can be a fear of like, yeah, but if I'm present all the time, nothing's going to get done. If I'm present all the time, what about all the things in the future that I have to plan for, this and that? I have found when you're truly present, the creative opportunity and potential of the present moment goes way, way up. Just like your capacity. It's almost like you're operating on a transformational level all the time.
Yes.
And that translates to your work, that translates to relationships. I would argue most relationships change through like present moments of full engagement in one way or another, right? There's a power to true like presence. But even mentally, like when you're really, really present, for me, if I'm working on something and I'm really, really present and I'm somewhat detached and I'm trusting the process, that's where the magic really happens. The other part of it is we spend so much energy trying to understand, manipulate, control future events. Mm-hmm. I think 80% of that energy really is just, it goes to nothing. We're spinning our wheels planning for all these different scenarios. So although it seems like, hey, practically it makes a lot of sense to be spending a lot of energy in the future, in reality, it doesn't work that way. That's why I think it's very wise what you were saying, just try it out. Maybe make a commitment to like 30 days as an experiment. I'm going to try and just be present and not control things for 30 days. See what happens. That's really wise.
Yes. That's a great action step. You know, 30 days, they can stick it in their muck manual, put string around their wrist or something to remind them that whenever they look at the string, just take a micro moment and just get present. Mm-hmm. Do it 100 times a day. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll take a total of 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, isn't it fascinating? You're in the planner business, but you are bringing presence and beingness into the planner business. I mean, how totally radically cool is that? And people who have not yet befriended presence are like, wait a minute, you're saying don't plan, but you've got the life outlet. How do you? And again, you have to try it out because I'll just put it this way. So I spent my Christmas with the Life Atlas, and it was the most beautiful kind of week. I lit a candle. I got really present. Mm-hmm. And I answered the questions about the next 90 days, the next year, from the place of presence.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, future serves the present moment. And the present moment serves the future. They live together as complementary pairs, but they're infused with this sense of connection to all, which is what presence is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not fear-based. You're not worried. You're not mm-hmm. freaked out. You're trusting the moment. And from there, those are the best plans.
Mm-hmm. There's so much here. part of what I'm hoping to do with the Monk Manual is like a judo move of redirecting energy. And what I mean by that is I think the problems that most people think are going to be solved, they're trying to solve something. They see productivity as the answer to certain problems. I don't think the problems are super well defined for people, but they sense like, oh, I need to be more productive. That's what's going to help me. That's what's going to make me feel better. I think through my own journey, I've just realized I've gone deep enough there. I'm a big believer that if you get honest enough with yourself and you feel out certain recesses of your own heart, there are places that are fairly universal. So like to the degree that you understand yourself, you also understand other people. I don't think everyone's the same, far from it. But I do think that there's aspects of ourselves that are fundamentally the same. And so the idea is trying to take what people are looking for, maybe through productivity, and redirect it towards what they're actually looking for. Which is actually this feeling of like beingness. So even with the Life Atlas, yes, it's about goals and moving towards goals. And yes, we do appeal to that, but it's not really about goals. Because at the end of the day, all the things that we're pursuing is just material for our being and becoming and for applying ourselves and creating some good. And I think our measure of our lives, as we're going to look back on it, is how present we were in all the various moments and how we chose to show up, right? How we just chose to show up. I think of it almost like when I was in school, we used to have these things called Scantrons. We'd fill in like these little black circles for like standardized tests, and then they get scanned in. I think of it like, okay, you could take your entire life and you could make each one a day. Each day is like a little bubble, and it's just our choice. Like how much do we want to fill in that? Like how full do we want that to be? And then that's our life. Like, it's like, how much did we show up in the moments? I can show up 60% right now, or I can show up 100%. And forever, that's going to be what I chose to do. There's a burden that comes from that in some ways, because it gives us a lot of agency. The car is ours to drive, right? At the same time, it's extremely empowering because the car is ours to drive. Like, we can go and do what we want to do and create the good that we want to create. And I think people do experience this nature. I think nature has this way of making us slow down because there's nowhere else to really go. I mean, I guess you can pull out your phone in the middle of nature, but most of the time it does slow us down. There's even kind of like atmospherically this feeling of time slowing, I think, for a lot of people. But when you really get slow, you realize, man, this is a lot richer. Everything's a lot richer. You start noticing like there's a lot here. Like there's a lot of really cool, good things in my life, around me. And that's really rich as well.
It is. And I agree with you, what you're saying. And the privilege, and it is a privilege, to be able to talk like this, and that we know we have a choice. We can be lost in our thoughts and our worries and our concerns and our material, whatever, or we can be here now. I mean, that is really just a profound privilege. So I'm just delighted. I'm really delighted that Monk Manual has found a way to kind of do this. And it's experiential, right? So I have a feeling people are starting to taste what we're talking about just by, you know, engaging in that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, because in Flying Lead Change, you talk about there being seven qualities or words. I don't remember the exact language you use, but kind of pointing to the operating system of horses,
principles.
Which is principles.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's care, presence, safety, connection, peace, freedom, and joy. When you think about these different areas, care, presence, safety, connection, joy, peace, freedom, is there one that stands out amongst that group as maybe the one for us personally to pay the most attention to, either because it's the one that we've suboptimized the most often, or because it's the one that deep down just creates the most wellspring of what it is we're looking for? And if it's a false premise to my question too, you can say that.
No, it's not at all a false premise. I mean, it's a Venn diagram and everything is kind of holographic in a way with these seven principles that create thriving inside the equine culture. But of all of them, I would say the core one is the one we've been talking about for most of this podcast, and that is presence. Presence provides the foundational premise of I am, just period, I am. And the very act of being present, of being in the space of presence, connects you to that concentric field where all of us, all beings, rocks, trees, plants, animals, clouds, rivers, humans, are connected. And from there, then, you know, safety, connection, peace, freedom, and joy can happen. Without presence, the rest can't happen. So, yeah, it's presence.
What I'm hearing is all of those things can only be found in the present. And I would assume, and again, I don't know horses well enough, but part of the gift of horses that they bring is just the gift of presence. They're not in the future. Yeah. They're not in the past. They're there.
Yeah. And they're not there because they're dumb animals. They're there because in the present moment, that is where, you know, what Senge calls the emergent future arises, right? So there are... Gosh, I don't know how to speak about this quite, but there are molecules forming towards the emergent future that you can sense when you're in the present moment. Mm-hmm. Animals of prey are profoundly present because it's in the present moment that all the information and data is there. Mm-hmm. And without that data, without being highly attuned to all that data, they would perish. They would get eaten by the lion or wouldn't find the water or would miss the vibrations in the earth that are telling them that some other animal or horse or human is coming. And so it creates an attunement that is highly sensitive, wise, and poised to respond appropriately because they're not lost in past or future. Mm-hmm. We would do well if we practiced to live in such a way. And there's this interesting thing about energy conservation. So we're predator and prey, but our culture largely develops the predatory nature of us, of our brains. But we're also prey. And prey animals are highly sensitive. Prey animals work in a collective fashion, and prey animals are very good at conservation of energy, which I think is a lesson we could all learn from the horses. For a horse, if they expend energy unnecessarily by worrying, by running around and being silly, doing things that aren't necessary, then they don't have enough energy to get away from the lion or go to the next watering hole. Humans are expending energy unnecessarily all the time. If you think about it, you know, the kind of tyranny of email and these artificial emergencies that come across our desk, and we're just blowing energy all the time instead of conserving our energy. And part of what presence does is it allows us to be deeply attuned to the moment, and we really think, is this a conversation I need to have? Is this a word I need to say? Is this an email I have to respond to right now? And the more that we conserve our energy, then we use our energy for things that are more important. So, you know, there's just this whole world that opens up when we start to hang out in presence. And conservation of energy is just one of them.
Mm-hmm. To take that idea as well of the conservation of energy, I also think the other piece really pragmatically also shows up when maybe we do need to act, but we're not actually paying attention to it. So to give an example, I think in relationships, it can be the sort of thing where if we were to really pay attention, we could notice like, oh, there's some real issues going on here, right? But we don't tend to actually notice those things until they get so bad that it's kind of like a clanging like cymbal or something. And it's like, okay, yes, I really need to deal with this. But usually we can actually, if we pay attention, we can sense things much earlier. And then it's a lot less difficult to attend to those things because they haven't
100%.
Progressed. I think it's a relationship with ourselves. I think it's our health.
Yes.
Physically speaking, there are large periods of my life where I just was entirely unaware of my body. Like any of the data that came from my body, it's like I didn't even, now to the degree where I'm like, oh, I feel that. Now I can actually say I don't think there's any way I would have even felt that in the past because I just wasn't paying attention
present.
To it. Yeah.
Yeah, we weren't present. It's so fascinating you're talking about that because, yes, there's the conservation and energy, and then there's the, like, what we can attune to that does need our response. And recently, I adopted a third dog, and, you know, it wasn't something I planned. It just needed to happen. And I have two very dominant females, and I thought, how am I going to just make this happen? The dogs have to get along with the horses, the cats, the people, the clients. This is a huge thing that the dogs have to do. And now I've got this third entity coming in. And I started to up my dog training game, even though I'm not a dog trainer. But once you have more than two dogs, it's a pack. And I learned to spot these things, these micro gestures, mm-hmm. like just the glance of an eye or the turn of a head or the lick of lips or, you mm-hmm. know, just a change in posture. And that's when I address things mm-hmm. right then. Mm-hmm. And instead of waiting until that gesture turns into a snarl mm-hmm. or, you know, that gesture turns into a bark, catching the micro gestures, it mm-hmm. required so much presence. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, wow, what if I was like that present? And I think I am with my coaching conversations, you know, really just watching for these micro gestures. But these little places inside my body, like you say, that there's some data here or within relationships or with my team. And sometimes, to be honest, sometimes I don't want to know because I don't want to deal with the problem, right? So mm-hmm. I'll kind of mm-hmm. deliberately be obtuse. Mm-hmm. But that costs me, right? And so these micro things that happen in the present moment, really, if you address them now, it's not a big deal later or not as big deal. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And I would wager that a lot of times we have like some hint of it and we don't want to know. Right. I think I smell smoke. Right. I think I smell smoke. So maybe I'll go in the other room. I'll go in the other room. Right. Maybe it'll put itself out or I don't even think it's conscious. But I do think 100% we avoid those things. Which I think can make sense, and sometimes things resolve themselves on their own, but a lot of times things get worse if we don't turn to them. I want to start bringing the conversation to a close and ask you, trying to take some of the ideas that we've been discussing, and in your work with Equus, you're bringing people to interact with these various horses, but then also introducing them to maybe different ideas, different modalities, different ways of being. Is there any practical advice you have for individuals? Maybe they're listening and they're saying like, hey, I want to be more present or I want to practice into some of the things we've been discussing. Do you have any advice for them and some practical things that they could be doing?
Yes. So a couple of things. Anywhere in nature, nature has a vibrational frequency that does bring us to presence. Dogs, cats, plants, trees. If meditation's not your thing, and frankly, it's not my thing either, I would rather just drop in as frequently as possible throughout the day, then practice going out into nature for brief periods of time, 5 minutes, and just hanging with a tree and feel what it's like to be with that tree. There's a entrainment that happens between your nervous system and the system of the tree that'll assist you. So that's one thing that I would suggest. The other is, it's related to this idea of presence. Presence isn't a void. Presence is full. It's full of everything, all of what it feels like to be, right? So we've been taught to suppress feelings and sensations. We've been taught to label them. This is a bad sensation. This is a good sensation. This is a bad emotion. This is a good emotion. All of that keeps us from presence. So instead, open all the doors of your beingness and feel all the sensations as is. Just be with them. Be with the tension or be with the flutter of kind of nervousness or be with the joy. Be with it as a sensation before you even label it as something. Just be with the softness or the jaggedness or the heat. This will build not only a capacity to be more present, because you're okay feeling all feelings, but it will also cultivate an ability to be with things without reacting and expending energy unnecessarily. Those would be my two.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So Kelly, we're going to go into a bit of a rapid fire question round here. If you could talk to your former version of yourself 10 years ago, what advice would you give yourself?
I would tell myself, not to worry, Oh, and I would tell myself this one really important thing. Sometimes people are very wedded to their prophecies. Oh, this will never work out, or she'll screw me over for sure, or this will never happen. And they're very, very wedded to their prophecies. When you see people wedded to their prophecies, turn and walk the other way. Don't try to save them from their prophecies. That would be the biggest advice I would give myself.
I want to ask a follow-up question, but I'm going to keep going. What's something you're trying to cultivate more of right now in your life?
I am wanting to cultivate the capacity to tolerate tension better instead of rush to relieve tension.
If you could give one piece of advice to people on how to live a more potent life, what would it be?
Be present.
What's something you know for sure?
What I know for sure is that we are wired for love and connection, that that is the stuff which we're made of. And therefore, we can return to that very easily.
What's something you're still trying to figure out?
Oh, I'm still trying to figure out boundaries and how not to please so much.
Well, Kelly, I want to close here first by thanking you so much. I not only appreciate you taking the time, but I also just appreciate who you are and the fact that, again, I'm not putting anyone on a pedestal, but I always enjoy and feel grateful for the individuals that I come across who I really see at the end of it all are seeking to create good and create more of what you were just saying, a sense of love in the world and connection. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for opening the space that we could have this kind of conversation, Steve. It's very unusual. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. It's so gratifying for me. Where can people learn more about you? And I think you maybe mentioned that you have a discount code if people want to go ahead and get a copy of your book. Could you maybe share a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So if people go onto my website, which is Equus Inspired, E-Q-U-U-S, inspired.com, and go to the shop, you can select my book and enter the code podcast50 and receive 50% off my book. And, you know, the website has lots of ways to engage with us that are everything from complimentary and not expensive to come on here and have a retreat, a private retreat, and do some coaching. So I just encourage people to follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook, and that's at Equus Inspired for all of those. Yeah, sign up to our newsletter. Thank you.
Beautiful. And I'm going to close by sharing one quick anecdote as well that I hope will be a piece of encouragement for anyone and potentially also maybe direct some more people to Flying Lead Change, because I do think it can be a really helpful book. You know, for a long time, for a lot of our interview, Kelly actually had a cat on her lap that she was petting that must have hopped up at some point. For a long time, I actually really disliked cats. I really disliked them. And it was something that I had to work through over a period of time. And I ended up realizing that the reason I didn't like cats was because cats are very instinctual. And then in many ways, cats were tied into my own conception of emotions. Not very easy to control, a little bit unpredictable, kind of like a little touchy here and there. And I share that because I think it's easy to think of, okay, this is a book about horses. It's not really a book about horses. It draws from wisdom of horses, but it's actually much more about wisdom traditions, if anything. But with that said, I really encourage individuals, if it's the sort of thing where you're like, I don't know, learning more about rewilding or learning more about how am I going to connect with myself or presence, if that especially is something that you're like, I just don't really have interest in that, it might mean that it's actually the perfect book for you. It might mean that it's actually that you're actually the person who's going to benefit most. Because when I look back on my own life, a lot of the things that I would adverse to were actually the things that were the things I needed most. And so I just want to close with that because I do think it's an important thing. And I think that in general, the ideas of rewilding, of opening up, it's something, especially for individuals maybe coming from the Monk Manual community who tend to be a bit more intellectual, these are dangerous ideas in the best possible way. So, Kelly, thank you so much for joining me, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again sometime.
Thank you so much, Steve. Have a beautiful, beautiful year.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Potent. If you'd like to learn more about Kelly Wendorf and her work helping leaders get to the next level through the Equus Institute, please visit equusinspired.com. That's EQUUSINSPIRED.com. I like to end each episode by encouraging you, the listener, to identify something from today's episode that you'd like to change or incorporate into your life as a result of what you heard today. Don't let ideas stay ideas. Find one small action you can take starting today to set yourself on a path to a fuller life. If you haven't already, I invite you to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review. This is a free way you can support this program and help us reach more individuals who are seeking to live a fuller life. You can also follow us on YouTube and Instagram. Links to both are available on our website, thepotentpod.com. And now, some inspiration for the week ahead. A hunter seizing a little bird known as a nightingale was ready to end her life. However, endowed with speech, she addressed him, saying, "What good will it do for you to kill me? I cannot satisfy your hunger. Release me, and I will impart to you three principles from which you can gain great advantage if you adhere to them faithfully." Astounded to hear the bird speak, he agreed to her terms of freedom. "Listen then," she continued, "never pursue the impossible. Secondly, do not mourn over a loss that cannot be recovered. Thirdly, do not believe in things that are unbelievable. If you adhere to these three principles wisely, they will be of great benefit to you." True to his word, the man set the bird free. As she soared through the sky, she began a most beautiful song, and upon finishing, said to the hunter, "You are foolish, and you have lost very valuable treasure. Within my belly lies a pearl larger than an ostrich egg." Filled with regret at her escape, he immediately set his traps again to capture her, but she outwitted him. "Come into my home, dear bird," he pleaded, "and I will treat you kindly. I will feed you with my own hands and allow you to fly freely." The nightingale replied, "Now I am certain you are a fool and have disregarded my advice. Do not regret what cannot be regained. You cannot capture me again, yet you have set your traps for that purpose. Furthermore, you believe there is a pearl larger than an ostrich egg in my belly when I am not even close to that size. You are a fool, and a fool you will always be." With this reassurance, she flew away. The man sadly returned home, never again laying eyes on the nightingale. Until next time, wishing you all the best.